Hooked on Health, a Go Loud original.
Welcome along to episode 3 of the Hooked on Health podcast with Eric Donovan. I'm Will O'Callaghan from Off the Ball on this Go Loud original. Eric Donovan is here with me. Eric, how are you getting on this week?
All good, Will. How's things?
Yeah, I'm really good, Eric. I think probably helped a little bit by the good weather we're having here in the middle of the summer, and that now we've got two podcasts in the pocket. They've been received really well so far. Ushie McConville, Mary Holgrain. They're available to listen back for anyone who's joining us late here on episode 3. We're a month out now from the Tokyo Olympics. Really exciting time for anyone who's a sports nerd like me, probably learning a little bit about some sports you've neglected over the last 4 years, or in the case of these games, 5 years. But it means it's a great time for you to pick a guest from the world of track and field. And you've picked a really special one from an Irish context this week. I remember watching David Gillick fondly when he won European gold medals in the 400 metres at the European Indoors back in 2005 and 2007. They were both achieved before he'd even reached the age of 24. So there's that feeling that when he went particularly to Beijing in 2008, many people thought maybe he wouldn't peak until London 2012. But the hype and expectation about Gillick going to Beijing in 08 was crazy. And I think, as we're probably going to hear, it didn't really play out in the way that he would have hoped. He had a few injuries then in his late 20s, is my memory of his career. He hung up his spikes what felt way too young, kind of late 20s, early 30s. But he's reinvented himself in retirement, and people will have watched him on TV winning Celebrity MasterChef. And then he became a trackside reporter and one of the best around, an analyst for RT's athletics coverage. And he's going to be heading over to Tokyo in a few weeks' time to be there to lend his expertise on the TV. I think David Gillick this week, Eric, a really interesting person you've picked.
He's a very interesting guest, Will. And, you know, something that's very interesting about David Gillick as well is that, like, he wasn't this young running prodigy. You know, he, like, in many cases, major medal winners are people who have medaled at schoolboy or schoolgirl level or junior or youth level or the underage level coming through. But David Gillick wasn't one of them. He was a late bloomer. You know, he never gave up. He never stopped trying. And then when he got to the senior level, you know, he performed and you know, stood on top of the podium twice in two European championships. And, you know, he's the record holder in Ireland as well, over 400 meters indoor and outdoor. So, but like that, you know, what's very interesting about David is that he's so articulate and eloquent in how he conveys his story and describes his story, his life story, and about how he at points in his life felt that he was ill-equipped to deal with life after sport because of the, you know, not reaching the, even though, like, two times European champion is not just to turn your nose up at, like, but by his own high standards, he felt like, you know, he didn't achieve what he really wanted to achieve, like, you know, or maybe felt that that he came in a bit under par or whatever. I certainly wouldn't feel like that. But and then he felt ill-equipped to deal with life after sport. So, and he struggled with that. He struggled with trying to make that transition from retiring so young and knowing what you're doing from one end of the day to the next for years and years, and then suddenly you're left to your own devices to create your own pathway, create your own plan. He really struggled with that, and he talks about it and speaks so honestly about that, and the strategies and the tips that he used to kind of to get out of that and to get his life back on track. But such an interesting guy.
Something I always find intriguing too is that, like, and I'm going to keep this on the athlete example here to keep it on the same track, so to speak, no pun intended, as David Gillick, is that you get someone, say, like Ciarán McGeehan, who even as a junior athlete is already being called the next Sonia O'Sullivan, and she's challenging Sonia O'Sullivan's records. So the expectation always is that Ciarán McGeehan, once she kind of grows into her body and gets a little bit older, she's naturally going to be a senior star. It's almost like you look into the crystal ball as a teen and it's guaranteed that she's going to be great. I always have got huge respect for grafters too, you know, like Gillick, who comes in at a time when the 400 meters in Ireland was very, very competitive too, and he makes himself the best athlete at that distance within the country. And he continues to work hard and work hard and work hard. And while he may not have been the stellar teenage athlete, not too dissimilar to lads who don't make, say, their minor team or women who don't make their minor team, but then go on to be really good players when they get older, there's a lot to admire in someone who puts that kind of work and graft in as well, Eric.
Hugely. But that's what, you know, David Gillick is. You know, he's a high achiever. He's a grafter, and he's a resilient individual who found a way, who always found a way, and who always tried to strive. He always strived to be better than he was yesterday. And it's an interesting chat. You know, he gives so many good insights and reasonings behind how things were and how things are, and what he's doing today in the area of mental health and well-being as well, and in the corporate world as well. He's using his, at one point he felt that, like, you know, that all of his life experiences through running and everything wasn't really much of much use to him. But now he realizes that they're an incredible asset to him, because he's using them now to inspire other people. Like, the tools and the skills that you learn through sport are very transferable into other areas of life, and that's what he's doing today.
We're going to listen to your chat now in a moment with him, but I'm just wondering from your perspective, because in some ways David retired from one career and then re-emerged and went a different way. You retired from boxing and then decided to go back into it. Like, given that you also retired from a sport at a fairly young age, like, you're talking not too different here, 27 versus about 30. How did you find that kind of readjustment after sport? Because I'd imagine no different to David. You've spent so many years knowing that it's right, I'm getting my nutrition and training right so that I'm peaking to hit these events, and this is what I want to achieve, and everything is laid out, and your coach is a huge part in planning what you're going to do, to then all of that stopping and the bright light stopping. Was that actually a difficult adjustment for you as well, Eric?
Yeah, I suppose it was quite difficult, but I knew I had to do something to bring a bit more security to my future, because, you know, boxing, well, at the level that I was at, was precarious enough, you know, like, you had to keep reaching the highest standard on the world stage in order to continue reaching the criteria for your funding from the sports council, etc. So huge pressures. And, you know, suddenly at 27, I wasn't number one anymore, and I wasn't getting funded by Sport Ireland anymore. And I didn't have any education. I didn't have any work experience, and I had two young kids. And I was like, well, how am I going to provide for them, for me, for, you know? So that was the point where I went back into education and as a mature student. And luckily enough for me, that was a good thing, because I felt like I was able to kind of develop in different areas of my life, and, you know, not just from the sporting side, but the academic side, and build a bit more knowledge and learn a different trade. You know, I went into the area of counseling, psychotherapy, and of course, then I came back into boxing, but I feel like I'm boxing better today because of that break, and because of what I've learned in that break, because I've learned more, I've learned about myself in a different way, in a different aspect. You know, I grew and developed, and now I know that the outcome of a fight is not going to be the be all and end all, and I don't have this unnecessary pressures on me where boxing is everything. It's not everything, you know, but now I'm able to box with a little bit more security, knowing that whatever happens, I'm going to be all right. And then you can express yourself freely and go and enjoy. And when you enjoy it, when you enjoy doing what you're doing, you know, you tend to operate at the optimum level.
Well, let's hear your conversation then with David Gillick, the former Irish celebrity MasterChef winner, also a three-time European medalist. This is what happened when David sat down with Eric.
So I'm delighted to introduce my next guest. I've been a huge fan of his, both on the track and off. There's a clue in that. He's a 2 times European champion, 2008 Olympian, national record holder over 400 metres, both indoor and outdoor. He's written 2 best-selling books. He's won the Celebrity MasterChef. The list goes on and on. It's David Gillick. David, welcome to the show. How are you?
Here's Eric. Thanks for having me on. Great to chat to you, and looking forward to this because I know you'll bring me places now where a lot of people wouldn't go. So looking forward to chatting to you.
Yeah, once we're walking though, because if we're running, you leave me behind.
Well, I don't know at the moment now. I'm a bit recovering. I'm not as fast as I once was either, unfortunately.
Suppose just to start off, David, I like to check in with people and just see where they're at the moment because it is difficult out there. I'm just wondering, how's life for you at the minute?
Yeah, look, it is, and I'm no different. You know, it's we've had our ups and downs over the last, like, year. You know, it's crazy to even say a year. But, you know, I work for myself. My wife works. We've got two small kids. Oscar, who's just gone 5. Olivia's 2.5. You know what I mean? There's just so much change and uncertainty. And I've had good days. I've had bad days. But I think by this stage now, we've managed to, I suppose, get into a routine, you know. And I think that's kind of key. Like I said, like it's always changing. And I think with all that uncertainty, you're always kind of looking for when things will go back to normal. But, you know, I think it's a new world we live in. And maybe the normal routine that we once had is always going to change going forward. But I think family, you know, they're all well. I think that's the positives. My parents and, you know, my immediate family are all keeping well. And we're just kind of trying to find our way through this.
Yeah, well, that's it, isn't it? When we put things into perspective, you know, we just want the people around us, our loved ones, to be well and to be healthy, and that's the most important thing. We will get through this. I notice you're sporting a bit of a band-aid there at the minute. You're telling me you had a bit of a procedure recently.
Yeah, unfortunately, like when I retired from athletics, well, I actually hated sport for a period of time, but I grew up playing a bit of GAA for my local club, Ballantyre, and I went back and played with them, and about 2 years ago, I actually ruptured a pec muscle. So my pectoralis muscle, give it its full title. And I didn't do anything about it. And then over time, it wasn't really kind of getting any better and it was causing a bit of issues. So I kind of decided now's the time to go and get it reattached. So I did that. And it's slowly coming back. You know, I'm only out of kind of surgery. But yeah, do you know what it is? It's like, it's always the way in life. I think you take certain things for granted, you know, and, you know, I'd be kind of an active person. I'd like to get outside and all the rest of it. And I think when you can't do something that you love to do, you know, you can get a little bit frustrated, but you know, it's important for my long-term health that I had it fixed and kind of looked after. So yeah, like I said, I'm not as fast as I once was and I'm not really doing a whole lot of running now, but we'll get there.
Yeah. Well, we wish you a speedy recovery with that. I noticed recently you were getting behind a Team Ireland campaign online called Don't Scroll By. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, so I'm involved with the Olympic Federation Athletes Commission, and the commission was set up off the back of Rio 2016 when there was an awful lot of change in terms of the Olympic movement in Ireland. And one of the key things was that we really wanted the athletes' voice to be heard. And thankfully, the powers that be, Sarah Keane and people in the now OFI really respected that. So the Athletes Commission was set up. And what we kind of learned over the last number of years was by just engaging with the athletes, engaging with like Olympic athletes, you know, what were their concerns? What were their issues? And one of them was around racism, discrimination and hate speech. And I suppose, you know, when we look at society in Ireland, it's getting more and more diverse and our teams that represent our country are more and more diverse. And there was an issue about 2 years ago with a young athlete competing in the European Youth Olympics and represented Ireland very, very well. And on social media, there was, you know, posts about the success of the athlete. And some of the comments, which were very surprising, majority were positive, don't get me wrong, but there was quite a lot that they didn't critique or, you know, analyze the athlete's performance. They actually were commenting on the color of their skin. And I think that was a real eye-opener to where we are as a nation, as a society. And, you know, unfortunately, racism is present. And when we saw these comments, we were like, you know, this is a young athlete. We don't want that athlete seen and we don't want friends and family. And that's where we said, like, well, what can we do? What are the things that we could do now? And people live on social media. It's part and parcel of today's life. And we just kind of said, well, you know, if people are on it and they see something that they don't like, do something about it. And that's where Don't Scroll By, you know, delete it, ban and report. That's what we're asking people to do. So if there is a comment that you don't think is right, well, do something about it, because you know, and look, you're a sports person as well. You know, when you put yourself out there, you're going to get people that are going to criticize your performance and tell you that you could have done things better. But you know what? It's unfair then to criticize the way they talk, the way they look, the color of their skin. That's not what it's all about. So that's the main reason that I've been involved in it. And to be fair, we're getting great support. And I think it's a really, really well worth campaign that everybody can actually do something about.
Yeah, I think it's a great campaign. We can all play our part. There's absolutely no doubt about that. You know what's sad? Like that in this day and age, we're still dealing with this level of racism, hatred and discrimination. And it can be so detrimental for anybody, but to a young athlete who is out there just trying their best and giving it their all, it could really just knock their confidence and could change their whole career.
It can change a career. And like, you know, it's... I suppose like in my time and there was no social media, you know what I mean? So it was very much like, you know, there was no comments and things like that. The only thing would be in the paper or something like that. But, you know, nowadays, social media, particularly for young people, like it's online, it's cyberbullying. And bullying, when I was growing up, took place in the playground where teachers or parents could spot it. They could see something and maybe do something about it. But when it's online, it's almost hidden. You know, people are hiding behind keyboards and just writing comments in. There's nobody's reprimanded on the other side of it. So, you know, it's just creating awareness of where we are at and what is going on and, you know, trying to do something about it.
Have you any personal experiences of having to deal with online bullying or abuse or overcoming anything like that?
No, like, I think to be honest with you, like, I've never had... racist comments or discrimination about the way I look or the way I speak or anything like that. Like, obviously, you know, I've trained with athletes that would come from mixed heritage backgrounds and things, and I have seen it from their perspective. But personally, no, I haven't. The only thing would be like comments about my performances and things like that, which, you know, let it be said, like, we all try and be really tough. We all try and say it's water off a duck's back, you know, and we don't read our own press. But we do, you know, you read articles about how you performed. And if you scroll down a little bit further, that's where you see comments. And look, I'm thankful and I'm grateful that the majority have been positive, but it could just be one. And in my career, yeah, there has been one or two comments that have really kind of got to me and annoyed me and, you know, cut me deep certain days when you might be coming off the back of a poor championship or a poor performance. And, you know, it's those kind of like single comments that tend to kind of just stick into you a little bit more. And I think anyone who's at a performance or at a level of performance, be it TV, be it business, be it sport, you know, when you kind of have the courage to put yourself out there, it does come with the territory a little bit. And yeah, like some people just want to have a pop at you for the sake of it, which, you know, it's probably just no need for, but it's unfortunately where we are.
Yeah, it's one of those sad things about social media. And it's a pity because social media has great potential, you know, to connect people and unite people. But unfortunately, that is one of those ugly features and I don't like it. But you just reminded me of a time back in my life, actually, back in 2010, when I won a European bronze medal in Moscow. And it was a huge achievement for me, massive achievement. Like, it took me years and years to win this medal. And I'd done an interview after winning the medal. And when I got back home, I looked at the interview again and there was a few comments underneath. And one of the comments was taking the mick out of my accent, how I spoke, how I didn't pronounce certain letters and everything when I spoke. And now suddenly, I wasn't thinking about my medal and my great achievement, and I was thinking about how to reply to this person, how to reply to this individual. And I wrote out so many replies and I deleted them, and then I wrote them out again in a different way and I deleted them. And then I just kind of caught myself in the act and I was like, Eric, what are you doing? And I just stopped. I just stopped there and then.
But isn't it sad though? Like, you know, you won a medal and you compete at the highest level. They're the moments that you should be cherishing and should be enjoying. But yet, there was a comment that was stuck in the forefront of your mind. And we've seen that, like, you know, we've seen that with some of our younger athletes, with our athletes that in certain circumstances, they're a bit nervous to represent a country for the fear of the repercussion as to the way they speak or their heritage or the color of the skin. And like, that's not right. That is absolutely not right. So, you know, and, you know, it's not just Olympic sports. It's rugby. It's soccer. It's GAA. You know, we're seeing this across the board. And unfortunately, it's the ugly byproduct of social media. Because let's be honest, we're not asking people to get off social media. It's part of life now. You know, it's just, it's the part of the way we live. Kids are growing up with social media. So, you know, it's all about how we can just make it better.
Yeah. Yeah, totally agree. Look, it's a great campaign. That's the Don't Scroll By campaign from Team Ireland. Can you take me back to the start of your career? I mean, like, you've had such a fantastic career, so much success. But I don't think, now, and I could be wrong, did you have any international success as a juvenile or underage when you were coming through?
No, you didn't. I wasn't.
That kind of just proves my initial thought. Because for most athletes, international athletes, successful ones on the world stage, let's say whether they're Olympic, European or world medalists, a lot of them would have had international success coming through as juveniles, as underage or schoolboy or schoolgirl. But for you, you didn't have that kind of, you never collected medals at that level, but you still never gave up on yourself, and you had that belief and the resilience that to keep going and to think that one day, you know, I'm going to get there. And then you achieved and reached the pinnacle and got to the very, very top in your senior career. And I think there's great lessons and learnings in that for everybody. But I'm sure you had your doubts along the way too.
Yeah, God, geez, did I ever doubt? Yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, probably, like, I think everyone has their doubts. It's what you do with them and how you control them. You know, I participated in athletics. I did GA. I did soccer growing up. I was the fastest in my class. Like, that was probably where it all kind of started, and you win your school sports day. But I never made any international, like, juvenile teams or anything like that. And I just, like, people always ask me that question, like, you know, why did you continue? I think I just enjoyed it. I think, like, I was just happy doing it, and I just enjoyed it. And as I got a little bit older, like, you know, my latter teenage years, I began to kind of see that I was improving. And I think this is the key thing when you're growing up. Like, we're all growing at different rates. We're all growing at, you know, and, you know, you're hitting puberty at different times of your life, where other people might be going a bit earlier, sort of grown, they're bigger, they're faster, all that sort of stuff. But I just enjoyed running, and probably I was a part of a team, even in athletics. Like, my school, St. Penilla's, had a good tradition of cross-country running. And I was just, like, a member of that team. I didn't score on the team. There were six on the team, four to score. I was always fifth or sixth, but I enjoyed it. And I got, like, I suppose when I got a little bit older, maybe like fifth year, I had a bit of a break. I won a national medal, and that gave me huge confidence. And then it was like kind of junior. I didn't make the team for the World Juniors in Jamaica, but I got sent as part of a relay team. And that was just a great experience. You know, Jamaica, Kingston, Usain Bolt, all of this. And that was really the catalyst for me to go, oh, do you know what? I want more of this. Like, maybe I can improve. So I decided there and then that, right, I was going to become an athlete. And even at that age, like, I wasn't a standout talent or anything. Like, and like, it came quite late. And I was probably, when was I? Kind of 19 when I really focused on athletics. And then about 2 years later, 2005, I got that big breakthrough in the European indoors and I won a medal. And, you know, that was where I suppose I came from, like, being completely under the radar to suddenly you win a medal in a sprint event. I think it was like the first medal in about 76 years in a sprint event, you know, because we weren't known as sprinters. And again, that kind of belief. But again, that was a challenging time, Eric, because suddenly I came home and people were like, oh, your man's going to go and win the Olympics and beat the Americans and all this sort of crack. And then you're kind of going, shit, like, oh my God.
Yeah.
You know, there's an element of pressure. And I probably didn't deal with that right, because it was all brand new. And even it was probably brand new for our organization, like Athletics Ireland at the time.
Did you not believe that you could become a European champion? Like, when you got out there, were you just of the mindset that I'm just going to give my best and do my best? Did you not envisage yourself standing at the top of the podium in the European Championships?
I'll be honest. Not that I didn't believe in myself, but it was more about, like, I never even thought about medals. It was very much, that was my first individual championship. So I was delighted to kind of get a senior vest. And the big thing for me was to, you know, to run a personal best, you know. And that's where I suppose sports can differ. Athletics is very statsy. So you have a number against your name. So for me going into that, it was like, right, here's an opportunity for me to run fast. And in hindsight, it was probably the best attitude because I just focused on myself. I took it one race at a time. I didn't worry about like the final or the podium or who else to beat. It was like, okay, David, execute your race plan. And that's exactly what I did. I ran well. I got into the final. And again, same sort of thing. Okay, execute your race plan. And then lo and behold, the race unfolded and I found myself crossing the line first. And I think that race then gave me massive belief because there was probably an element where I didn't believe an Irish athlete could compete at that level in a sprint event and win a championship. And it's funny because like in my kind of career, there was the likes of Paul Heschen, Dervla O'Rourke, Joanne Cuddy, people who actually did go on and excel in sprint events at major championships. And the following year, Dervla went on and won a world medal at indoors. Yeah. And, you know, we've always kind of had the conversation where I think, you know, we both helped each other in those couple of years where, you know, she saw me do it and we motivated each other. And that's kind of what we're seeing now with the current crop of athletes that are running really well. You know, there's an element of belief. And I know you know this from boxing and even been in kind of the amateur side of it where, you know, you have that talent coming through and success breeds success. So, you know, at that time, did I believe I was going to get in the podium? Probably not. Okay, I'll be honest, probably not. But post that championship, I think we all kind of said, you know what, Irish sprint athletes can be up there with the best of them.
We worked off the same philosophy in the Irish High Performance Boxing Team. I mean, we never talked about medals. It was never a discussion. But even though, in the back of your mind, the ultimate goal was always to win a medal. Like, how do you measure world class? You measure world class by medals, you know, winning medals at major events on the world stage. So, but it was always drilled into us about the process, one round at a time, 1 minute at a time, just performance. And in your case, it was the same. You know, you focused on delivering your best performance and maybe, just maybe, you might possibly get a personal best. But lo and behold, your best performance brings you across the line in first place. And suddenly you're a European champion. And there's great buzz and there's great momentum leading into the Beijing Olympic Games. And look, let's face it. Being an Olympian is one of the most prestigious titles that you can have. And unfortunately for me, it's something that eluded me and I never quite got there. But I have to live with it. So not everybody gets there, but then the people who do get there, it doesn't always turn out to be the experience that they expected. And I heard you speaking before about how gutted you were about your Olympic experience.
Yeah, look, I was. And I look back at my Olympic experience and it was shite. And I'll be honest about that, you know. And it's probably taken me a good couple of years to look back now and go, do you know what? Yeah, I am an Olympian. And I'm very, very proud of that. I suppose, you know, when you're in that cycle, you know, and sport is very kind of funny because you're always working towards the next fight, the next race, the next championship, the next Olympic Games. And coming from athletics, like that's the pinnacle of our sport, the Olympic Games. So I suppose, you know, 2005, 2006, 2007, it was all about Beijing. I then qualified very early. I qualified in 07. So I was like, right, I'm going to Olympic Games. I tried to do absolutely everything I could, leave no stone unturned. And the result was, I probably just stressed myself out. I forgot about that key element of having a bit of fun, you know, being grateful that you can train full time and enjoy the process. I started, and that's a key word, and you touched on it as well, taking it round by round, race by race. I started looking a year down the line, Olympics, Olympics, Olympics. Everything was about the Olympics. And as it approached, I was running well, I was in form. But then I noticed things weren't right. I began to feel a little bit more fatigued and just things weren't really the way I thought they would be. Went to Beijing and I didn't run well. I ran the slowest time of the season and I was absolutely devastated. I was embarrassed. I felt I let an awful lot of people down and that guilt. And, you know, it was a horrible time. And even funny little things like people will go to Olympics and they come back with a tattoo. I didn't feel I earned a tattoo. I was like, I don't deserve that. And that was the way I spoke to myself. But one of the best things I did was I came back and I was living away at the time. I was over in the UK, came back home to Dublin, to Ireland. And I started going out with my now wife that year, Charlotte, and she was English. And I wanted to bring her to Ireland. And we went for about a week over to the West Coast. And I always remember like going over to, we were on Inishbofin. And, you know, you're looking out, very picturesque, gorgeous day, next stop, America. And we were just talking, you know, and she was kind of saying, oh, like, you know, how do you feel about the, you know, the year that's gone? How do you feel about the year coming up? And I was like, you know what, like, you know, I really need to start enjoying what I'm doing, you know? Yeah, like the Olympics didn't go the way I wanted, but I really need to kind of enjoy the process and enjoy kind of the life as an athlete. And if I want to continue in the sport, I've got to flick that off switch. I've got to allow myself to, you know, just have, you know, when I'm on, I'm on, when I'm off, I'm off. And that was really the catalyst going into 2009. And that turned out to be my best year, you know, 09. And then obviously kind of having a good couple of years. And, you know, it was actually very recent, about 2 years ago. It was my birthday and Charlotte went and got me a voucher for a tattoo parlor here in Dublin. And she was like, you know what, like, you deserve to go get those Olympic rings. And that's what I did. So it took me many years to go and get them. But now I look at the rings and I think, you know what, it inspires me. It brings me back to all the things that I've done in order to become an Olympian. And now being a dad and having kids myself, I want that to inspire them. And I think that's what it's all about. So I do right now look back. And I'm proud that the process, that everything that went in about becoming an Olympian, because it's something that as a little kid I dreamt of. It wasn't about personal best or records. It was like, you know what, I want to become an Olympian. And that's what it was about. That was it. So yeah, like it's great. It didn't go well, but I learned. I learned from it. And I wasn't afraid to debrief and ask myself some real critical questions and learn from it and move forward.
I'm delighted to hear you got the Olympic rings tattooed on your body afterwards. I'm laughing because it's actually one of the reasons why I was so gutted myself to not qualify for the Olympic Games was not being able to get the Olympic rings tattooed on my body. You know, most of my boxing buddies all had the Olympic rings on their arms and their chest, and they're going around proudly showing them off, and rightly so. I mean, the Olympic rings are a powerful symbol, you know, and what they represent and everything. So I'm really glad to hear that you got that done, and yeah, you do deserve it. You do deserve to have them. You mentioned a few things there. You know, in the aftermath of the Olympic Games, you seemed to hit a really low point. The whole experience didn't go as planned. It wasn't what you expected. You were devastated. You felt embarrassed and, you know, you put yourself down. You felt like you let people down. And then you talk about making a bit of a transition, a bit of a change to almost changing the perspective, changing the lens you're looking through and picking yourself up from that low point and turning it around and having a great year in 2009. So, I mean, that just doesn't happen overnight. How do you make that change and that transition, or what kind of supports or people helped you with that?
Well, you hit the nail on the head there. It was people. And I think, you know, when you look at, say, athletics and you watch Olympics or world champs and you see an individual running, throwing, walking, you know, jumping in an Olympic stadium or a major championships, the key thing for me was that I invested time into the key people around me. I came back and I was gutted. I was devastated. But, you know, what I did was I rang my coach. And I mean coaches. I had a S&C coach. I had a nutritionist. I had my own track coach. And we literally one day went out for a bite to eat. And obviously the topic of conversation was like, you know, what happened, right? How can we improve? And I think that was the key, because I think people saw a bit of resilience in me that, you know what, I wasn't just going to like keel over here. It was very much, all right, what worked well? What were the little things that we could have done better? And where are we going from here? And that's what it was. And I think I brought that level of communication to the group over the next couple of weeks and months. And we really began to like get everyone on the same page. So again, constant communication about, okay, well, what was I doing, you know, on the track and how that related to everything else. And I think that was probably the key moment. You know, it was like, okay, you know, we all believed that I could run 44 seconds and be up there with some of the best athletes in the world. But, you know, it was about how we were going to do it. So, you know, there's a great quote where a goal without a plan is just a wish. And it was probably times earlier in my career that I was just wishing I was going to run 44 and make finals and do this. Whereas I needed to put it into practice. I needed to focus on the actual tangible KPIs, the simple things that I could do and that I could improve upon. And I'm talking about simple things like, you know, going to bed an hour earlier, making sure that I was getting good, adequate rest, making sure that I was hydrating myself, having a breakfast every day, you know, simple things like that. So it wasn't a big almighty goal. It was like these little 1%. If I can do those, well, you know what? Then you're focusing really on the process and everybody's invested in that. But I think the key thing was that I looked at kind of like, okay, well, is there anyone I need to bring into this, like Team Gillick? Was there anyone that had like experience or value in different areas that we might have overlooked. And, you know, that was a key element to it. But also, I had to be really honest with myself. And I had to say, do you know what? I need to allow myself to enjoy this. I need to switch off. And what I learned was that if I'm happy off the track, I'm happy on the track. So my living situation, you know, who was I living with? Did I need to get out of sharing accommodation? And simple things like that, that maybe we don't focus on. We focus on our job. We focus on hitting our targets. We focus on our sport. But you know what? It's that holistic approach to it. And that's something that I really learned going into 2009.
Well, it's all those little 1%, isn't it? When they're all put together and added up, they make all the difference in the grand scheme of things. You retired quite young. And I know that injuries and just the body take, you know, the toll on the body would have influenced that decision to retire. I'm wondering, what was it like for you post-career, after sport, going back out into the normal day-to-day world? Was like, I mean, from the outside, it appeared like that was a pretty smooth transition, because I would have been watching you on my TV screen winning Celebrity Master Chef and writing best-selling books. And I'm just curious to know, was it as smooth as it appeared to be, or was there a huge void left in your life?
Oh, like, Eric, there was a massive void. Like, and it was probably something I never, ever kind of expected or even kind of was aware of. I retired at 30 after having probably about 2 to 3 seasons of really bad injuries. And, you know, it just got to the point where I felt I was ready to move on. And I felt I could at the moment, but what I realized was that I was struggling. And I didn't, like, I suppose I just went straight away from sport. I was like, I want nothing to do with this. I was resentful to what had happened, you know, in terms of injuries. And I hated athletics. I hated sport because I felt now it put me in the situation I was in. And that wasn't a good situation. It wasn't a good environment. My mental health began to deteriorate because I had no routine, no purpose. I had no get up and go. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And that was really frustrating because I was always determined, motivated. I always knew what I was going to do every day, every week, every month. You know, it was almost like, yes, I'm building towards something. Now I didn't know what I was going to do. I was waking up in the day and kind of in the morning going like, I don't need to be anywhere. And that was just a real negative cycle. And as a result, I suppose when you talk about fulfillment and contentment, I just thought I needed a job. I needed money. I need money. So I put a huge onus on money to be kind of that thing that's going to fulfill me. So I went chasing. I went chasing euros. And that was it. And then after a year of that, I realized, not a good thing. Right, I'm going to move on to the next job. And then I realized this isn't right. So I crumbled. And I've been open and honest about my mental health journey. I had depression. I was diagnosed with like anxiety, depression. I had suicidal thoughts. It was just, I just was in a dark place. So like all those valuable things I'd learned from an athlete, I chucked out the window. Why? I'm not an athlete anymore. Not an athlete. That was it. So my identity was just, and I was an athlete. And that's all I thought I was good at, was running around in over 400 meters, a lap at a track. So, you know, it took me a long time and I got a lot of help before I realized, you know what, like, you know, I am resilient. Like, look at all the stuff that I've done, the setbacks, I've overcame them. But I had to go back and remind myself of all these things. And that's where resilience, like, we're hearing a lot of it now. But, like, you know, it's not bought in a shop. But you don't just go in and get it. It's, you know, it's something that you build over time by reminding yourself of everything you've gone through in your life. And we've all had setbacks and, you know, things like that that have gone on. But you got to remind yourself of how you overcame them. So now, yes. Like, even dealing with all the change that's gone on the last year, like, I kind of felt at times that I was able to embrace this. I've been here before. I've dealt with change. I've dealt with setbacks. And that's the stuff that kind of helped me get through the last kind of couple of weeks and months and even years. So it took me a while to realize that. It took me a while to realize that, you know, I had the skills, you know?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. Loads of identification with you there. And it's great to hear you share that and be honest about your struggles, because so many people, I'm sure, have the same experience and experience the same issues, especially after a life of sport. You know, when you have so much structure and routine and focus every single day, every single week, knowing what you're doing, and then suddenly it's gone, it's all taken away from you. And that's why I struggled in my life when I stepped outside the Irish high performance environment, because in the environment I excelled and I progressed, but outside of that environment, I regressed. You know, I just didn't have the same support systems on the outside as I had on the inside. But like you, I almost felt ill-equipped to deal with life outside of sport, or after when I stepped outside of that environment. And then I realized, you know, that many of the skills, the tools, the strategies that I used in my boxing career are transferable to other areas in life too. And I think that's what you realized. You've come to realize that too. And you've developed a business now with a couple of friends called remotewellbeing.ie, where you do corporate wellness programs and you share your experiences. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so like I kind of started, I suppose, sharing my experiences and doing a little bit more in the corporate kind of world, and very much around wellness, well-being, and everything from stress management to resilience to food to nutrition and all this sort of crack. And then like it was going very well. And then COVID hit, and so I couldn't go into any corporates. And that's where I was like, okay, well, what can I do? So again, like a tool there was like, well, how can I overcome this? It wasn't like, oh, doom and gloom. Okay, what can I do? And that's where I kind of had it, obviously, over the years, built a couple of, you know, friendships, and got to work with different people. And I kind of thought, well, all right, well, you know, maybe together is stronger and together is better. So I looked around at people that I'd worked with, and I thought, you know what, maybe we can come together and offer something a little bit more holistic and do it kind of virtually. So basically, like, I had all this kind of knowledge, I suppose, and I just put it on an e-learning platform. And together with other people, we were able to build a program. That's where Remote Wellbeing kind of started. And now we're running programs in corporates over a couple of weeks, and we're touching on all those areas. And particularly now that people are dealing with that level of anxiety and worry because of the change. And that's why kind of Remote Wellbeing is something that I actually get a big kick out of, because I feel like I'm giving something and I'm offering like a bit of help and experience, and, you know, with other people as well. It's holistic, and we're looking at all areas of well-being and wellness. And I think it's, you know, I find it empowering, actually, you know, that you can help people, because we're all dealing with this in our own different ways. And some days we're positive, some days we're negative, but that's normal. And I think even in terms of my own journey with mental health, like, I don't shy away from kind of being open and honest, warts and all. Sure, like, if anything, it's helping people and it's removing that stigma, particularly from a male perspective, you know, because I think when you come from sports, it's bigger, stronger, faster, you know, show no weakness. But we're human. We're human. So, you know, right now we, you know, it's going pretty well. We have programs running over periods of weeks with companies, and I'm very kind of happy. I'm very, like, I'm enjoying it. And I think that's what it's about, like, sharing stories. And I know you do a little bit as well. And, like, you know, like, that's what it's about. And, you know, whether it's, regardless of like the age profile of your audience, you're helping people. And I think by telling stories, it's a great way of learning. Great way of learning.
Yeah, like, there's something really special about real, honest storytelling, isn't there? Like, I just like people giving it to you straight. You know, I just love to hear high profile people sharing their experiences of struggle, of the dark days, the setbacks, and overcoming that. You know, it just, it almost makes you feel like, it makes it okay for you to struggle too. You know, you feel like if they can do it, then so can I. But I think there's a huge shift, isn't there, like, with how we speak now and how we talk. Like, we're going away from that old kind of cliche talking to more real, honest, authentic speaking and storytelling. And I think podcasts and all of these platforms are helping with that. We're hearing a lot more. We're hearing a lot more honesty. We're hearing from a lot more people and a lot more experiences. And that's what I'm trying to do with this podcast too. Not just talk about the glory days, even though they're important as well. But in order to be successful, you have to embrace your vulnerabilities as well, and your setbacks, and the, you know, the losses, and, you know, they're all part of the journey.
I think you're right. Like, you know, it's real. It's authentic, but it's also like you got to be aware of how people learn. And like, I was doing an awful lot where you go in, you give a talk, and you walk out the door, and that's the end of it. Whereas, you know, it takes time for people to learn and make change. So again, by looking at, okay, yes, you're doing live elements to it, but people kind of learn in different ways. And I think using technology by, you know, putting the content that you have up on a platform that people can go in and use it when it suits them. And particularly now that people are working from home and they're homeschooling, they've got kids and vulnerable people that they're looking after, that, you know, they might be able to make a live webinar, but they can go on then in their own time and get that information and get those stories and all that content. So that's kind of, it's that blended approach, I think, you know. And for me, that's kind of real long-term sustainable change. And that's what it's all about.
I've been watching you over the last while there, working for RTE, the punditry, the analysis, and especially your work in Rio, at the Olympic Games in Rio, and I just thought you were absolutely brilliant. Your knowledge, your insight, and your ability to communicate with the athletes and the viewers. You know, you do a great job there, I must say. I'm just wondering, what's your thoughts on the Tokyo Olympics? Do you think they'll go ahead?
Yeah, look, it's I appreciate the comments. Yeah, like it's Rio was a great experience to be over there and be on the other side of the track actually as well and kind of see it through a different lens. Yeah, look, Tokyo, I think it's going to go ahead. Yeah, I do believe it's going to go ahead. I don't know. No, look, spectators probably won't be there. Will media be there? I'm not sure. I am due to travel, but like we're kind of unsure. The Olympics will go ahead, okay? It's my only concern is that, you know, I want full fields. I want all athletes that have qualified to go. My worry is that, you know, they could turn around and say, well, we're taking 50% or 30% athletes, you know, just because there's so many involved. And, you know, I think that would be a big shame. But I think it will go ahead. And I think right now, athletes are preparing for it to go ahead. And I think that's the right attitude. I think that's all you can do right now is prepare that you will have an Olympic Games, because that's what the athletes want. You know, it's the pinnacle of the sport. It's something that they've been working for their whole lives, you know, and now that you have another year to kind of go again. So I think overall, yeah, I'm pretty confident with the communication that's coming out from the Olympic International Olympic Council that will go ahead. And it's just managing it now for the next kind of couple of months. Like, obviously, there's an awful lot of chat about, you know, vaccines and things like that. And don't get me wrong, everybody's on the same page as the most vulnerable in society should be vaccinated first, and frontline workers should be vaccinated first. But, you know, let's see where we're at, you know, May time, June time, in terms of vaccinations going into an Olympic Games. But there's a lot of management involved. I think, you know, they've released kind of roadmaps and plans about how they're going to deal with it. But I think they are preparing themselves for an Olympic Games, which is great.
Well, David, thank you very much for joining us on the Hooked on Health podcast. You've been so good with your time, with your contribution, and thank you for sharing your story with us and for your honesty. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. I'm just going to ask you for one last piece of advice for any young athlete out there who may be struggling at the moment, dealing with very abnormal times. Their career has probably taken a bit of a blow over the last year. So if you have any little tips, strategies that, you know, may help them deal with the current circumstances.
Yeah, look, and I think, you know, there's so much that I'd love to share, but I think the simplest thing is just focus on the now, okay? Don't get too kind of bogged down on what things are going to be like in 5-6 months down the road, or even flip back and go, oh, I wish it was back in 2019 when things were normal. Just focus on today. What can you do today? Because I think that's the key to it all, you know? If we can just look after ourselves in the present and take it one day at a time. And just the last thing as well, you know, always, always have a little micro goal, okay? So, you know, we're talking Olympics, we're talking about things that are months down the line, but what are you going to do in the next couple of days? Give yourself something to aim for, because a lot of people's hopes and dreams have been dashed, you know, like holidays and all the stuff that we look forward to, but bring it back. Do something for you, you know, do something for you and work towards that. I think that's really, really important.
So that was David Gillick, twice European indoor champion at 400 meters, speaking with Eric Donovan. And David's an intriguing guy, Eric, to be honest. Like, the kind of support and the care he still has for athletics ran through the conversation that you had there. You know, his feeling that there's a great next generation coming through of Irish athletes, and he wants them to do extremely well along the way. And he also came across as a guy to me that seems quite settled and happy in himself now, probably a lot happier than he was 10 years ago, really.
Yeah, definitely. You know, great chats with him. I really enjoyed that discussion. He's such an interesting guy. He really is. And a lot of things he spoke about there, huge, huge lessons for everybody. You know, one thing that really jumps out at me was the, you know, he went searching in the wrong areas, searching for happiness, you know, how he thought money was going to bring him happiness. You know, it's like putting the cart in front of the horse, you know, and even just something as simple as that, learning that, you know, that's not meaningful, that's not purposeful, that's not going to bring me happiness. To be able to realize that and to adjust that, and he tries to work in more meaningful, he tries to take on more meaningful jobs now and stuff that brings a bit of purpose to his life. And yeah, family man, but highly
highly knowledgeable around the area of athletics. You can just hear him when he speaks about it, like the passion runs through, and no surprise that RTE have snapped him up, you know, because he for the casual fan or any just sporting fan watching, you know, he gives brilliant insights and analysis and great background information.
Yeah, and look, I think we're all guilty of that as well, Eric, that we decide that there are certain things that can bring us happiness and bring us satisfaction. And I'm sure there's plenty of things that we all kind of chase in life, whether that's, you know, the job promotion that you might be going after. You might have your eye on a particular house or an amount that you want to have in your bank balance. But the reality is that whenever you meet any of those goals along the way, if there's something that you just want to meet because there's something you want to tick off, you'll always find there's something else that you want after that. Like, you can never have everything.
Never, no, and you keep chasing, you know, because that's the thing, you know, with it, when it comes, when you are kind of going down the road of material things to bring happiness, you know, it'll just be one thing after another. I use this old, I heard this, a guy say this one time, this is a person in recovery. He said, I used to pay a high price for low living, and now through my recovery, I'm paying a low price for high living. And it just made so much sense, you know. It just made so much sense to me that the real things in life, the real meaningful and purposeful things in life for us, are actually free.
Well, next week on episode 4, remember, if you want to listen back to any of the previous podcasts, you can do so particularly on the Goal Out app, or you can subscribe to us on any of your podcasting networks. This is a Goal Out original podcast, Hooked on Health with Eric Donovan. But you can listen back to previous conversations that we had with Mary Holgrain or with Ushi McConville, going back to week 1 of the podcast. Or if you're listening to us again, you want to listen back to David Gillick, that's probably the best place to do so. Give us a subscribe, maybe a like or a review. It can help the show a lot if you're enjoying the conversations we've been having in recent weeks too. Next week, we're kind of pivoting off into a slightly different direction, Eric, in terms of our conversation. We're going to be joined by a guy called Rory O'Connor, but I would imagine most people probably know him better as Rory Stories.
Yeah, Rory O'Connor could be anybody, could be the boy next door. But, you know, when it's Rory Stories, you know exactly who we're talking about. And he's our guest for next week. And I'm looking forward to chatting with him. He's a brilliant story, fascinating story, you know, and how he developed and made Rory Stories into a phenomenon, really. And he's over 1 million social media followers, and he's provided a lot of entertainment for people and gave them something to smile and cheer about during the tough days of the pandemic. So I'm really looking forward to speaking to Rory. He's a massive platform, and what I really like about him is he uses that platform to speak about some important issues that we face in this country and around the world, which is mental health, depression, anxiety, etc. He speaks about that so well, and I'm glad to hear and glad to know that he does that.
Well, episode 4 of the Hooked on Health podcast is going to be Eric Donovan sitting down with Rory Stories. We hope that you can join us again next week.
Subscribe to this podcast for free on the Go Loud app.